Kia ora, and welcome to Amran's Podcast, episode 206. Today is Thursday, March 25, 2010. Yes, I know. I didn't do a podcast yesterday, and I said I was going to. Things happen. I've always said that if podcasting isn't fun, or if it's too much of a burden, it's not worth doing. And yesterday, it wasn't worth doing. No, the truth is, I was really tired and just not into it, and I decided rather than just sort of force myself to do a podcast, I would just skip it. And as it happens, I already knew by then that the schedule has already changed. The several times postponed immigration equality interview has been postponed again till next week. So it turns out that I'm going to be doing a normal recorded episode for tomorrow. Tomorrow evening, North American time, I'm going to be doing the live show, of course, which I'll post on Saturday. And then Sunday, I'm going to do the draw of the winner. By the way, a reminder that all entries in the competition must be sent by midnight Friday, Eastern Daylight Time. And in North America. And I will repeat that again tomorrow, and I'll give all the other time zones in case people in other places don't want to work out what those times are. I'll do it for you. Well, more or less, anyway. But I'm not going to be promoting the interview as such anymore. It's just going to suddenly show up one day as a podcast episode because it's easier. And it's also, I don't know, maybe I'm jinxing it by promoting it. I don't know. But things have just happened. It's nothing, no dramas or anything. It's just, you know, things happen. That's just the way it is. Today, I'm going to talk about some things in the news because I haven't been lately. And of course, things have been happening. But first, I wanted to touch on something I didn't talk about last time when I was talking about healthcare and so on, the passage of healthcare bill in the U.S. And then I compared it to healthcare here in New Zealand. It was about the specific process of the House passing the bill, and I just wanted to comment briefly on how very different the proceedings in the two houses are between the U.S. House of Representatives and the New Zealand House of Representatives. Of course, New Zealand has a Westminster-style parliament, as does Australia and Canada, and it's named after Britain's parliament. And the speaker controls the proceedings, and they do things differently depending on the countries. For instance, North Americans can, I believe they can watch the question time in the British House of Commons. I don't know what channel it's carried on, probably C-SPAN, I'm guessing. I know that if Americans can't already, you will soon be able to watch the Australian House of Representatives or whatever it's called, I'm not even sure, their question time. Over C-SPAN because they've struck a deal with a new public affairs network in Australia called, what's it called? A-SPAN or something? Or APAC? I can't remember. Anyway, the point is that it's similar to C-SPAN, but in Australia. So you'll be able to see theirs. I don't think that C-SPAN carries the New Zealand Parliament question time. However, you can watch it online through parliament.govt.nz. I'll put a link in the show notes if I remember. It streams over the internet, and as far as I know, it's available for anybody in the world to watch. I don't think it's limited, but of course, it happens. It starts at 2 p.m. our time, Tuesday through Thursday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, but not every week because Parliament doesn't sit every week. And it's a fiery exchange. Usually, the point is that the parties get to ask questions of ministers. The idea is to hold the executive accountable to Parliament because Parliament is the ultimate authority in the country. And they will ask questions. And the procedures are somewhat similar even when they're debating a bill. The members of Parliament never talk to each other, ever. They only talk to the Speaker. And that much is true in the House of Representatives in the U.S. as well. They'll often say Mr. Speaker, Madam Speaker, whoever's chairing at that time. However, one thing that's very different is that, especially during question time, they will shout at each other across the floor. And when they're not recognized as speaking, you know, they're sitting in their chairs. And so it can be, especially during question time, it can be really loud and raucous. And from time to time, the speaker will call for order. It's particularly noticeable in the Australian question time when you'll hear the speaker going, "Order!" all the time. And it gets really obnoxious, even more obnoxious than I just was. But the Australian one is somewhat more entertaining than ours in that the speaker will always say, the member for such and such will resume his seat. Whereas we don't say what the member for, the speaker will just say the member will resume his seat. because in the New Zealand Parliament, I believe in the Australian as well, when the speaker is standing, everyone else must be seated and silent. And but it's funny to hear the Australian speaker saying, the Prime Minister will resume his seat, or the leader of the opposition will resume his seat. We don't quite have that in New Zealand, at least not as often. Our question time is a bit more raucous than the Australian question time, so in that sense, it's a bit more entertaining sometimes. But it does help if you know something about New Zealand politics sometimes. But anyway, what struck me so different about it is that the speaker can stand and order people to shut up, essentially. And you just don't see that. I didn't anyway. When I was watching the debate on the final passage of healthcare, I didn't see the speaker telling people to be silent and to re-recognize the person to continue. Every once in a while, whoever was the acting speaker would admonish the fellow members to be respectful and things, but the debate wasn't controlled as tightly as it is in the Westminster systems that I've seen anyway. So that's just a little bit of compare and contrast I wanted to mention. But speaking of New Zealand Parliament, at the moment there's quite a controversy going on over mining, of all things. Specifically, the current government wants to open up mining on what's called the conservation estate, which means land that's held for its conservation value. It's held away from development and mining and all sorts of other things. Now, the government isn't being entirely up and up with the people about this. One of the leaders of the government, this guy named Jerry Brownlee, who I personally find one of the most arrogant and offensive members of the government, told reporters that it was a minuscule amount of land they wanted to take out of the conservation protections in order to mine. They said it was comparable to a postcard on Eden Park. And Eden Park is the rugby stadium here in Auckland, which is like hallowed ground for rugby fans. Well, TVNZ, which is our largest broadcaster, didn't exactly take him at his word, so they got a mathematician to check that. And he found that if you took all of the land in New Zealand and reduced it to the size of Eden Park, a rugby field, a rugby pitch as we often call it, that it would take 121 postcards to equal the amount of land that they want to open up. And I think that what we might be seeing is the beginning of the unraveling of this government, because I think they've grossly overstepped the mark on this and other issues as well. This is only the latest of them. They have been saying that they're going to get billions and there's billions and billions of dollars worth of minerals under these conservation lands. And in point of fact, they don't know that at all. They said that on this island called Great Barrier Island, which is in the Hauraki Gulf, it sort of shields Auckland from the Pacific. You can see it on any map. It's the biggest island out there. That there's this mountain that has $4.3 billion worth of gold and silver in it. Only, Jerry Brownlee was saying that, only the problem is that the leading authority on it is a geologist who estimated there's perhaps $1 billion. And you start to think, well, if they exaggerated the value by four times for that one site, how much else are they exaggerating about? But the thing is that they are, the New Zealand government owns all the minerals in New Zealand and under it. They nationalized them many years ago, probably, was it 30 or 40 years ago, I think, mostly because they knew they were going to be striking oil and that they wanted to make sure that that was controlled by the government. Anyway, the New Zealand government gets a royalty of 1% of the value of the minerals. So, you know, you're talking about a pittance for all of this destruction that they're going to cause. And it's already starting to have repercussions overseas. The Economist magazine blasted this call to mine on conservation land because one of the leading draws of people to New Zealand for tourism is the environment and the nature and all of this sort of stuff. And they're putting it at risk. The tourism industry is worth $22 billion a year to the New Zealand economy and employs 185,000 people. So it's a big industry. It's sustainable, and it is the largest single earner of foreign income for New Zealand. It turns out that the Prime Minister, John Key, never once asked anybody, any expert in the tourism industry, what effect mining would have on tourism. And he is the tourism minister, as it happens. So it looks like they're just pushing ahead with this for no good reason for New Zealand. The mining companies, incidentally, are all owned by overseas companies. They're not even New Zealand companies. And the government is saying, oh, well, yeah, so we don't get much money for it, and it's going to tear up all of the conservation, all this conservation land, but there's going to be jobs that are going to come from it, without any evidence whatsoever that there actually are going to be any jobs from it. They're projecting, they're assuming. And quite frankly, there's a lot of ordinary New Zealanders who think that this is going too far, that this just is not a justifiable thing to do. And I'm beginning to think that we may be looking at a one-term government for National. And of course, right now, the opposition is the New Zealand Labour Party. And they have pledged that when they are in government, they are going to reverse the government's moves and put the land back under protection of the conservation estate, which obviously would be a really good thing. And when you tie this together with some of the other things that National has been doing, raising the goods and services tax to 15%, cutting benefits for the unemployed and sick and so on, cutting taxes for the richest New Zealanders and not for the ordinary New Zealanders, penalizing people on the minimum wage, all these sorts of things. I kind of think that we may be looking at a return to power for Labour in the elections next year. Of course, it's a long way away yet. It's more than a year away, year and a half almost. And anything could happen, but it's not looking good for National yet. They're already having protests against them. And right now, that actually leads us into question number 11 on the competition. And that is, which New Zealand political party is currently leading the government? The answer is the National Party. And actually, guess what? Question 12, which party is the opposition? And the answer is the Labour Party. And you may want to think before you spell that. It's the New Zealand Labour Party. And the New Zealand National Party is the party of government. So there you go, questions 11 and 12. So that means that's up to 14 questions so far. So we're closing in on the third opportunity to enter the competition. Woo! One thing that was in the news that I haven't mentioned is that there's still continuing to be coverage of this Destiny Church. There was a report the other day that the head, the self-appointed Bishop Brian Tamaki, travels around with bodyguards who he has trained or gotten them to promise to take a bullet for him. Now, this is a really curious thing because I'm unaware of there ever having been a death threat against Tamaki, certainly not from the public. The only thing I can think of is a disgruntled ex-church member or maybe one of their family members might have a grudge for him, but it's not like he is in any threat. I mean, he's irrelevant to the majority of New Zealanders. But I just thought that was kind of interesting. And the church is in a bit of turmoil now, I think it's fair to say. And if I was to make a prediction, I would say that sometime in the next year, especially if this pressure keeps up on him, that Tamaki's going to pull up stakes and move to Queensland in Australia. That would be my guess. But, I could be wrong. Every once in a while I am. Well, occasionally, anyway. Right. Now on to some happier news. Auckland International Airport was voted the 9th best airport worldwide and the best airport in the Australia-Pacific region. And this is travelers in the 2010 Skytrax World Airport Awards, which I don't know anything about. But last year, Auckland Airport was ranked 10th, but it's moved up a little bit. And it's got to do because of its staff, which won an excellence award. I don't know, I suppose it's got to do with services and stuff. Now, Auckland Airport has been going through a lot of upgrades over the past few years. They started with the international terminal, which is much better than it was when I first came to New Zealand. And the domestic terminal has been dramatically transformed over the past few years. And it's so much nicer than it was before. I mean, the domestic terminal was kind of like a small city airport in the U.S. What comes to my mind, it's not quite as small as Toledo, but maybe Cleveland, Ohio, or somewhere like that. Just the sort of place where you kind of pass through and you don't want to spend a lot of time that's bigger than that. So that's probably not the best example, but it's much nicer now. It's much more pleasant to stay in. But just for your information, the top 25 airports in the world, according to these rankings, were number one Singapore, and everyone I know who's ever been to Changi Airport says that it is absolutely phenomenal. It's wonderful. But I've never been there. I don't know. Number two, Seoul Incheon. Number three, Hong Kong. Number four, Munich. Number five, Kuala Lumpur. Number six, Zurich. Number seven, Amsterdam. Number eight, Beijing. Number nine, Auckland. Number 10, Bangkok. Number 11, Vancouver. Number 12, Kansai. I have no idea where that is. 13, Centrair Nagoya. 14, Helsinki. 15, Copenhagen. 16, Frankfurt Main. Maybe they mean Maine. Anyway. 17, Tokyo Narita. 18, Brisbane. 19, Cape Town. 20, San Francisco. 21, London Heathrow. 22, Istanbul. 23, Bahrain. 24, Hamburg. And 25, Vienna. And of course, out of those, you will note that there's only one American airport, and that was San Francisco at number 20. And I have to say that as someone who's flown in and out of Los Angeles far too many times, I would much rather go to San Francisco than to Los Angeles. And the last time I was in the U.S., I swore I would never return to LAX, and unfortunately had to. But I'm hoping that I will never have to go through there again, because I'd really rather not. It's just such a despicable airport, I think. But anyway, be that as it may, and San Francisco's, I think, is quite nice. But be that as it may, it was kind of thrilling to see Auckland Airport come in at number 9 this year. In totally unimportant news, one of the leading news sites in New Zealand is called Stuff, which is owned by Fairfax Media. It's actually an Australian company, but it was started by a New Zealand-based company. It's stuff.co.nz. If you haven't been there already, there's certainly a link on my blog, and I often link to their stories on my blog. Well, they last year and this year, they've run a competition they call Blog Idol, and they start with all these people who apply to take part, and they're winnowed down to a few. And like, for instance, this year, it started in February with just under 400 entries, apparently, and then they were narrowed to a list of 10 finalists by a judging panel. And then these 10 people blogged, and over 3 weeks, it was narrowed down until there was a winner. And it was done through daily polls, the number of comments on blog posts, and also visitor traffic. I don't know specifically how they did that, because they haven't, as far as I know, they haven't said, but be that as it may, the winner this year is a 26-year-old gay man named Chaz Harris, who is also an aspiring filmmaker. His first short feature, I don't know if it's his first, but he has put a short feature online, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. I don't know if it's viewable outside of New Zealand. I obviously haven't tried, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is. But anyway, he's sort of cute in a twinkish kind of way, but it was just interesting. I wouldn't have guessed that. I read some of his entries, some of his blog posts, and thought they were good. I didn't read any of the others, so I don't have anything to compare it against. But considering how online sites in general tend to bring out the trolls who use them to just spew anti-gay venom, I was actually quite surprised that he won, although it could be that they were just counting the number of comments, not what they said. And if that's the case, these trolls would have ended up helping him, which is supremely ironic, I think. Now, every once in a while, people's homophobia ends up helping us, doesn't it? Now, last time, I also talked a bit about nzhistory.net. And it really is a terrific site if you want to know anything about New Zealand. They've got all kinds of stories about history and culture and various aspects of New Zealand from the earliest days until the present, or more or less the present. And there are a lot of things you can find out about on there that are really cultural touchstones. And one of those is the sinking of the Lyttelton to Wellington ferry, Waihine. Waihine, W-A-H-I-N-E, was, it's actually a Māori word, means woman, and the word for man is tāne. But anyway, it was New Zealand's worst maritime disaster in modern times, and it was one of those things that you just don't expect to happen in modern times. The ship foundered in a bad storm, practically within sight of Wellington, and 51 people lost their lives that day. And it was a huge disaster, and it was also broadcast live over television, obviously. Well, not obviously, but it was, throughout the country. And it was one of the first major live events like that to be covered by television, because television was relatively new. The first broadcast was in like 1960. And so this was a fairly recent development. And before we go any further, question 13, When did the ferry Waheny sink? And the answer is April 10, 1968. Okay, April 10, 1968 for question 13. Anyway, it is an event which still casts a shadow over Wellington. There is, and I don't remember the actual spot, what it's called, but just, you know, by the entrance to the harbor, there is a kind of a parkland reserve sort of thing where you can go, and there's a memorial to the Waheny, which I believe includes the ship's propeller, if I remember correctly. Anyway, it's kind of a picturesque spot. And if you do get to go to Wellington, make sure you go to the Wellington Museum of City and Sea, which is near the harbor, on the harbor, actually. In there, they have a lot of artifacts from the Waheny and an extensive description of the disaster and what happened and so on. And it's a great way to find out more about it, what happened and the aftermath and so on, because it really affected a lot of people at that time. And it was... Well, we haven't had anything like that since until the Erebus disaster, which is a whole other issue. So that did affect quite a lot of people. But also on New Zealand History .net, nzhistory.net, I was .nz. I always forget that part. I was looking through there. On their splash page, they currently have a thing about the 1960s, which is actually what made me think of the Waheny. But also they talk about television, they talk about protest movements, all kinds of stuff. They talk about the change in the economy in New Zealand in the 1960s, leading up to the 1970s when Britain entered the common market, as it was called then, and it caused a huge financial collapse in New Zealand when it lost its major export earner, because in the 1960s, Britain took about half of New Zealand's exports, and by the time it entered the common market, it was down to 15%. And it was caused a major economic downturn in the country and ultimately led to the neoconservative takeover of the government because of the repercussions. But if you go clicking around very far on the history site, you will find that, among other things, they're putting together a register of all the memorials in New Zealand, all the public, civic memorials. They're starting with the First World War memorials, which I find particularly interesting because I noticed when I first came to this country that no matter what small town you went to, you could find a World War I memorial. And they're still there. It's not like they've gone away. But a lot of them aren't as in good repair as they probably should be. And there have been cases where statues of soldiers have been beheaded by vandals and all kinds of other things, and sometimes graffiti sprayed on them. But it's because there was such a huge percentage of New Zealanders who lost their lives in World War One. Something like a quarter of the population, I think, was killed or wounded in World War One, and it had a profound effect on the country when you have losses and people affected. That many people lost or affected by an event like a war. So these memorials are everywhere. And a lot of town halls are actually war memorial town halls where the names of they're almost always called the honored dead, are displayed in perpetuity. And it's fascinating because, especially if you go to a small town, you'll see the names of people and their family, their relations are still living in the area. And the family name may be on roads in the area and that sort of thing. In big cities, that's probably less the case, but it's still true. The Auckland Museum, as it's commonly known, its actual name is the Auckland War Memorial Museum, and it was built as a memorial to the fallen. And there's a hall with all of the people listed from World War One, and there's another one from World War Two and subsequent conflicts. I mean, that's not the sole function of the museum. The main function is that it is a museum, but it also serves as a memorial to the dead. And that's where Auckland's Anzac Day services are focused every year at the cenotaph out in front of the museum. So the New Zealand History Online has been making a campaign of trying to document all of these memorials throughout the country. Eventually, they want to add other memorials, but their first target, I suppose, are these World War One memorials, which I think it's a great thing, especially because people may live overseas and they want to locate the memorial where their their ancestor or distant relative is listed, you know, those sorts of things. So far on the register, they have 453 public First World War memorials. And of course, as I said, they're trying to document all of them and then they'll move on to other ones. So question 14 is, how many public World War I memorials has nzhistory.net recorded so far? And the answer is 453. One last thing before I go today, and that is that Holly of the We're Mean Because You're Stupid podcast, is better known to most of her podcasting buddies as Fairy Princess Holly, is again participating in the Walk for Animals, the Animal Humane Society. And she is currently raising money for to sponsor her. And this year, she's matching donations up to $1,000, and $1,000, and her employer is matching contributions up to $1,000 as well. And she is, just check right now, up to 6% of her fundraising goal. So that's not bad at all. And I'll put a link in the show notes. But yeah, if you have a love for animals, you might want to throw a few bob over at Fairy Princess Holly to encourage her to do her walk. Now, I, of course, as I said, will be back tomorrow with another recorded episode. And at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, North American time, I'll be doing a live show on pride48.com. And at the very beginning, there may or may not be something that contest participants want to listen to, which will not be in the recorded episode, I can assure you. The recorded episode that I'll post on Saturday will not have any questions or anything else relating to the contest, except that I'll remind people of the deadlines, but that's it. And that is it for today. I will be back tomorrow, come hell or high water, with the final recorded episode before the drawing and your final gaggle of questions. That's it for today, everybody. Have a great rest of the day, and I will talk to you again tomorrow. Bye. You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrens Podcast at amrenspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrenspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed on a Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.